going on, everybody? Thanks for tuning in to Stories from the Foul Line. I'm your host, Nick Nasby, joined by the Philly boys, Mike and Mark. Guys, how you doing today?
I'm fantastic. I'm currently in Raleigh, actually at my fraternity house, and I'm ready to just record and have a great time. Having a blast here and ready to have a blast on the pod.
I just got back from LA, as I was telling you guys in the pre-show. I was there visiting some family for the week. And I mean, it's hard to relate Los Angeles to basketball when you don't go to a Lakers game, which I did not do while I was there. But I did get to see a little celebrity sitting at a restaurant table right next to me. I spotted Kevin Garnett's bald head a couple seats over from me, hanging out with a little girl.
A little
at the
girl?
Restaurant. Not a little girl, but you know what I'm saying. I'm not going to preface it like that. Not trying to expose KG here, but he was definitely on a date with somebody. And all I got to say, we hope so. All I got to say is that guy is very, very freaking tall in person. My mom was sitting next to me. She doesn't know shit about basketball. And she go, like, nudge me, like, is that a celebrity? Is that an athlete? I'm like, yeah, mom, that's fucking Kevin Garnett.
Yeah, I remember I saw Rasheed Wallace at the Vatican one time. Have I told this story before? I think I might have. I saw Rasheed at the Vatican. He didn't sign my autograph when I asked him. I was 14 fucking years old. And he was, you know, 6'11". It's like, there's one thing when you're tall, because, like, there's big dudes who are tall, and sometimes they're so big that you don't really know how tall they are because they're big, you know?
Yeah.
That's, like, what you'll see with, like, an O-lineman. Like, they're still striking, but it's not – you're not going to know he's 6'9". With Rasheed, like, he's just long, and he's 6'11", and it's like, how the fuck do you function in society? Did you – I read a stat this week, and this is probably going to surprise you guys. 7.5 billion people on the planet, or 7-whatever billion people on the planet – estimated amount of people over 7 feet tall. Can you take a wild guess how many people are over 7 feet tall estimated in the world?
Less than 1%.
I would say, yeah, I'd agree with Mark, less than 1%.
The estimated amount of 7-footers in the world is 2,800.
Yes, I mean,
out of 7
that's
billion.
Still great. That's so nuts, though. How many?
That's so small, right? Yeah. It seems so small. And it's because if you ever think about it, there's 7-footers on, like, almost every single basketball team. But outside of basketball, have you really ever seen one?
No, because you live in a city.
No, right? You've never seen one before because they all play fucking basketball.
Yeah, unless you live in, like, Germany. And that's
not
what
even
the
Germany,
funny thing
like,
is.
It's
like
fucking Sahara. It's, like, in the Congo, you know?
Well, think about somebody like Embiid, and this happens to a lot of players, is they haven't even picked up a basketball until the time they get to high school, but they're always looked at as like, dude, this guy is so fucking big. You can't teach height. So teach them how to play basketball a little bit and let them stand in the fucking paint, and they're going to be an NBA player when you're that fucking tall. And then some of them just develop great skills.
You know, when the coach for his college, I think it went to Hartford or one of those like a little ass school, when the coach showed up in his town in the Sudan, he was just like, that guy's playing basketball. He didn't ever play before, but he's 7'7", so it's like, you're just gonna play now. Do you feel like being a millionaire today? Because you can be if you choose, you know. So it's like, it's so uncommon, but it that's what it looks like when it happens, you know. That's what's crazy to me when I see them, especially the ones who are in shape in that size, because it's not typical. So you're talking about LA, basketball, and I read a stat today on dunksandthrees.com. I don't know if you guys know this, but the Lakers right now are the number one defensive rated team in the league.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised. I mean, they have a lot of guys who, like, are just guys that are dedicated to winning. I mean, they're buying into the Lakers program with LeBron, with AD, and they're guys that are going to go out and give their 120% each time. If you look at their games, I mean, they're not allowing, like, that. They're doing well on both ends of the floor, and they've kept their head above water with having LeBron and Anthony Davis out for extended periods of time. And that goes back to the Frank Vogel style of basketball, where Frank Vogel was always a good defensive coach. And now you're seeing that identity come through with these guys who are lesser in star power. It's not because he has AD and LeBron anymore. It's because Frank Vogel is actually implementing his philosophy as a defensive-minded head coach, which in turn is actually having a positive effect on the Lakers and makes them such a more dangerous threat, because once they get their 1-2 starting punch back at the helm the offense, they're going to be back to where they were last year as a team that's going to be no one to mess with, as a team that should be the favorite to get out of the West, and as a team that should be favored to win the NBA Finals, even with the Brooklyn Nets super team out in the East as well.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is this offseason, the talk of the offseason was how phenomenal the Lakers did. And bringing in guys like Harrell and like Dennis Schroeder that complemented a team that just won the NBA Finals, yet they had the best offseason. That rarely ever happens. When you win the finals, you typically lose a lot in the offseason because people pay the winners. In this case, they signed all of these pieces to sort of take a backseat and be that complementary to what they already had in AD and LeBron. And instead, the season's gone very unplanned for them. I'm sure they expected to rest Anthony Davis and LeBron a little bit more this year than they had previously, but these injuries have caused those kind of players to join the starting lineup and take that lead. And by no means have they been flawless. They've definitely gone through some rough stretches as expected. But for any other team, when you lose your top two players, they would have fallen out of the playoff picture. And these guys have been out for a long period of time. And I think they have been able to sort of stay afloat thanks to the moves they made in the offseason. The one guy I'm just personally sick of on that team is Kyle Kuzma is a bum, in my opinion. This guy might be the least consistent player in the NBA at this point. I watch them on a regular basis, and you don't know whether he is going to put up 3 points and go 1 of 8 from 3-point range, or he could go for like 25 on any given night. He's just so frustrating. And when they decided to keep him in the Anthony Davis trade, they valued him as the most valuable asset when they were putting together this super team as a guy who could serve that role. And I think he's been a huge disappointment, honestly.
The advanced metrics hate him. He is below average in absolutely every single statistic you could look at. When we're talking about estimated plus minus, 37th percentile on offense, which is actually surprising if you think about it, 25th in defense, which is not surprising at all. The only thing that he has any kind of decency when it comes to, in terms of at least the advanced stats, is when it comes to rebounding, with the rebounding percentage. And at 6'9", as a power forward playing small forward, that's expected. I agree with you. I think that they overrated him, but what he looked like in his rookie season, I don't blame them. What he looked like he could be in his rookie season was going that was a high value asset. I wouldn't have touched him either. You know, so I agree with them in 2000 and whatever, 17 or 18 or whatever, to trade everybody except Kuz, see what he's capable of doing. He was on the team averaging 20 a game before anybody came there. So it was clear that they wanted him to continue to do that. He hasn't been doing it. He hasn't been efficient. He's atrocious on defense. He doesn't know how to play defense on anybody 1-4 when he could definitely have been better at that. I don't think he's working on it. I truly think the LA lifestyle has gotten to his head. Same way that even though he had a good fourth quarter last night, the Miami lifestyle has definitely gotten to Tyler Hero's head. He's become they've both become celebrities. They've both dated high profile people. And if you want to tell me that doesn't make a difference, that's just not true. It absolutely does. If you're 24, 25, or in Tyler's case, 21 years old, and you're dating somebody who's got 5 million Instagram followers, you're on the cover of tabloids, you're getting looked at with paparazzi, people are hounding you in the streets, like that will get to your head. And eventually you start to think to yourself, okay, well, do I really need to continue to practice? I'm already famous. So that's what's happening, I think, with him, and I think it definitely happened with Tyler, too.
No, yeah, and I mean, that rings even more true now with the presence of social media. I mean, social media is probably one of the more chief factors in affecting like players' performances on the court through an off-the-court type of source. And Tyler Hero and Kyle Kuzma are two guys that are the staple children of social media within the NBA. I mean, you see them all over TikTok, you see them all over Twitter, you see them all over Instagram. And if you're telling me that mindset of, hey, let me become more than just an NBA star, or hey, let me like grow my social media following, doesn't affect your play, then you're wrong. I mean, there's guys out in the sports world, like a Trevor Bauer and like some other players within across all four leagues, that utilize social media properly and utilize social media to most, to where they can gain themselves more money and that it doesn't affect their play. But with Kuzma and with Hero, it certainly has to a pretty significant degree. And while Hero has a lot of time to correct that and grow, and granted, he's going through a sophomore slump, which a lot of players in the NBA do, Kyle Kuzma at this point, he's pretty tapping out at his potential, which is pretty sad to see from a guy that was like a very, that looked like a, someone to mess with his rookie year, and a guy that they were looking to build around, be a part of, like maybe that third wheel behind LeBron James, or maybe that player that LeBron could lead on. But that certainly wasn't the case, as Kyle Kuzma really capped out, peaked way too early, and now is on a sliding scale of ineptitude, honestly. Let me tell you, if the Lakers get a decent offer for a vet, like, not saying this would happen, but like a Markieff Morris type of guy in the offseason, don't be surprised if Kuzma gets moved to a team that's in rebuild or a team that's like in the middle trying to get some younger talent and see what they can get out of him. But I wouldn't be surprised to see Kyle Kuzma moved in the offseason whatsoever at this point.
I think that that's a trend in the NBA that we don't talk about enough, too, is that it's always this thing where players get drafted with these high profiles, and we all say they're going to end up in LA at some point in their career. People were saying that about Ben Simmons from the minute he got drafted. I don't always think that that's the best fit for players, and now we see a lot of guys go the opposite way where they get drafted to LA or Miami, these high profile markets where there's a lot of pressure on you and the party lifestyle off the court. And what happens to those guys is down the road they sort of underachieve in that big market because they are partying too much and getting caught up in that lifestyle, and they move on to a smaller market where they really find a balance and success. Lonzo Ball is a perfect example of that. I think getting out of LA is what he needed to do. And you could even make the same argument for Brandon Ingram, although I don't think he exactly got caught up in that lifestyle in LA to begin with. But he's done the same thing where he moved on to New Orleans. And yes, it's also taking on more of a role on a bad team where you are the star now. But I think it's really beneficial for some players to get out of those markets. I would love to see Kyle Kuzma elsewhere, but I'm also just concerned with, to me, it's not just necessarily off the court issues. He is just playing so inefficiently, on the court in a game in, game out basis. It's just that nothing he does is consistent, and I don't think there's a part of his game right now, like Nick was saying with the advanced metrics, is there's not a part of his game that is consistent on a game-by-game basis. And you need to have something like that. If you're a volatile scorer who can go both ways on any given night, at least have a part of your game that is consistent. And when you don't play defense, you better be scoring every game, and he's not doing that.
Yeah, I mean, the inefficiency is really what gets me with Kuz. But, I mean, that's not uncommon today. I think that the issue with him is that his style of play is starting to become, it's wearing out its welcome pretty quickly. In the sense of, he is a ball-dominant scoring small forward. Like, that's his size. Like, he uses his size relatively well, but he's not good in the post. He's okay from mid-range, and he's okay from three. And those things together, when he was getting the usage rate that was necessary for it, turned into damn near 20 points a game. But now that defenses are recognizing him, and now that there's other options there, I think sometimes it even looks worse, because it looks like sometimes he's taking shots that he could pass up to somebody who is more open, because that's what it was 2-3 years ago when he first started in the league. So I think that's where the real issue lies with Kyle Kuzma. I mean, I've never been sold on him. I don't even like him being a top of a conversation. I think we should just move on, because it's like, whatever. He's plateaued. And he's been plateaued for years. But, you know, if we're talking about California basketball, I think the only person that warrants actual airtime is one Wendell Stephen Curry Jr. And that's because, I don't know. Did you guys know that was his name, by the way? His name's Wendell.
Isn't it Wardle, though? Not Wendell?
Wardle. Did I do it wrong? It's Wardle Stephen Curry Jr. Yeah, like Wardle. It's the second.
Yeah, you're going to Wardell Stephen.
Wardell.
Yeah.
Oh, that's where the Dell comes from.
Yeah.
So he's junior.
Yeah.
Just a full junior. That's hilarious.
Yes, got it.
Who would have thought that somebody would have the same name as their dad and just go by their middle name? Like, maybe they had a falling out.
You became a lot better than his dad and didn't want that stank from Del Curry's name from the Hornets days.
He's on an absolute tear. A tear that, honestly, we haven't even seen from Steph Curry before in his entire time in the NBA. Well, he's coming off a bad game last night. He had the third worst true shooting percentage of the season last night against the Wizards in the loss. Russ was on him. He was hounding him pretty bad. I think that Russ was out on a war path trying to make sure that he was recognized as being like a better version or something. I don't know what goes on in that fucking guy's head, but I think that's what was going on there. So, but besides that, Steph's been averaging, I think, damn near 45 points a game. They said in the last 10 games or in the month of April, he was averaging a number that was like untouched since Wilt Chamberlain.
Yeah, it was
I think
it was
and like, he was doing that.
Yeah, I think it was like 42 points a game. That's why I believe it was.
And he was doing that while shooting 10 threes a game. Like, let's just go through the different games, right? His usage rate is astronomical right now, but that's fine. That's what we're used to. 10 threes, 11 threes, 11, 10, 8 threes. I mean, these are numbers that 10 years ago people would touch maybe once in their career. He did it in the last 7 games. He's done it 8 times.
So this is So let me read out Steph Curry's stats from April, just in April. He's averaging 40.7 points per game on 55, 50, and 91 shooting splits in 10 games. He's 72 of 143 from 3.
It's unbelievable.
Like, that's actual NBA 2K numbers on all the sliders up. Like, you're maxing out the sliders. You want the stats. You want to get all the Hall of Fame badges and all the, you know, game achievements on your Xbox or PlayStation, what have you. But this guy's actually doing it in real life in a whole goddamn month in a 10-game stretch, and where he's actually has had, but albeit from last night before that, 11 straight 30-plus point per games in a row. But what's crazy about that,
including a 50-pointer,
yeah,
he has a 60-pointer this season.
Yes.
He had a 47-pointer, a 49 points, 42, 41. You know, and this goes before he was out for a couple games. Mark, I want to hear this from you. As the season winds down, I know that you don't believe in this, but I want you to just put yourself in the mindset of somebody who does. Make the case for Stephen Curry being the 2021 MVP.
It's interesting you ask that, because this is something I wanted to bring up. Is about a month ago when we did our MVP ladder, I brought up the case for a couple of guys. Steph Curry was one of them, and they needed a perfect storm of things to happen. A lot of those things have happened now, except for the fact that Jokic still sits at the top. The issue, though, with the Nuggets, Jamal Murray now injured. Do they fall in the standings? Steph Curry has taken that opportunity. I named Steph Curry, Lillard, and Doncic, and Steph Curry, since I said that, has gone on an absolute tear, dude. In the past 10 games, if you take out last night, he has more three-pointers, 72, in the past 10 games, which is an absolutely insane number to think of. He has more than Chris Paul has all season. Chris Paul is a formidable scorer. More all season in the past 10 games. He definitely has that case for an MVP, but the Warriors' play is the issue. I just don't know if he's going to get that look because of the spot this team's in. And like, they've been winning somewhat, but they're only like, I think they've, in the past 10 games, they're like 6-4 or 5-5. So, I mean, the case is there. James Harden went down. LeBron, obviously, Embiid is still standing in his way because he came back and is doing what he's doing. I think if he hit that buzzer beater last night, they would have just given the MVP on the spot. The difference is Steph Curry could make that shot like in jump shot formation from the free throw line of the opposing court. I've never seen anything like this. Steve Kerr, after the game, like 2 nights ago, said that he's witnessed Kobe Bryant do this early on in his career, go through stretches similar. Michael Jordan went through stretches like this. I mean, Steve Kerr's seen all of these guys on a firsthand basis throughout one of the most illustrious careers we've ever seen, both playing and coaching. He said that Steph Curry is doing this at a level that is double what Kobe Bryant and Michael Jordan ever did as far as pure shooting dominance. I've never seen anything like it. And I mean, for Steve Kerr to witness this on a day in, day out basis speaks so much, because we know he's watched all of the best players. He's coached all the best players in the league and played with them. I think the case is there for him to be an MVP. Personally, I would rather see him win it than Jokic. I feel like I'm turning into like a Jokic hater, because he's just doing enough right now to win the MVP. I mean, Jokic has been phenomenal, don't get me wrong, but it's just, he is the formula of consistency, and it makes it really difficult where if Jokic doesn't get injured, it's his MVP. If, as long as he's playing in every game down the stretch, I don't really see how he loses it. But on the same breath, Steph Curry, if he turns this stretch in the past month to the rest of the season, he might actually make his way all the way up the ladder and win this MVP. I don't think it's impossible. His odds right now are the third highest. He's climbed all the way. He was like the 10th highest a month and a half ago. Right now it's just Jokic, Embiid, Curry. I think this is a story.
I think it's
for
crazy
the history
for,
of basketball,
for these,
doing
for
right
these
now.
Voters, these MVP voters. If you are able to vote for five guys, right? Let's just throw five names out there. Jokic, Embiid, Steph, Luka, Giannis. Think about who you're forced to leave off of this list now. You're forced to leave off of guy like Damian Lillard. You're forced to leave off guys like, I mean, you can even make a case for Chris Paul. LeBron gets left off of that, even though he's missed games, but so has Embiid. He's missed games too. The amount of names that are on this list this year are, in comparison to what we used to see, there's going to be some real big snubs on this first team All-NBA team, and probably on the All-NBAs just in general.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I mean, I didn't even mention Harden. I didn't even mention KD. Like, look at all of the names that you're forced to leave off of the list.
Or Kawhi.
Kawhi Leonard, that's another one. Or Kawhi, I mean, too. All of these guys are playing at that level.
Kyrie and Paul George, too. I mean, Paul George is playing out of his mind this last month, too. Like, no one's kind of talking about it. But Paul George went through a seven-game stretch where he was averaging 35 and 8 a game. The case for Steph Curry to be MVP is this. There's been two guys in the history of basketball that have won MVP that weren't a top four seed in their respective conference. It was Moses Malone back in the 80s, like I think 88, don't quote me on that, but it was Moses Malone, and it was what Russell Westbrook, the year he averaged a triple-double. And what Steph Curry's doing right now is similar to what Westbrook did back then in terms of willing a team of misfits and a team that really is outperforming what their mean output is by him putting that load on his back. And that's the argument you can make. You can make the Westbrook argument for Curry this year in terms that he's going out and he's single-handedly winning this team basketball games with his offensive output and his shooting.
And you also see the thing with that too, though, Russ's team went 47-35. It's not like they were bad.
No.
Right? He had a lot to do with that. Yeah. The Warriors right now, I'm pretty sure, are like a game over 500, right? Oh, or yeah. Like they're at 500. Yeah. They're not playing all that well. There is absolutely no help for Steph.
No.
So if they do get to the playoffs, I think there is a genuine case. But at the end of the day, you have to look at the guys who are carrying their teams to an elite status.
Yeah.
And that's a Nikola Jokic. You know, and here's the other aspect. This is the Jokic versus Embiid debate. Jokic has played 800 more minutes than Joel Embiid.
Yeah.
If it's ever not going to matter, this would be the season. But that has to count for something. 800 more minutes than Joel.
Yeah.
I don't think Joel can't miss a single more game to even be considered. But I think that Jokic is starting to run away with this, in my opinion. I think, and he deserves it. The fact that if he were to average 13 or 14 assists for the rest of the season, which is not really possible, but it's what it is. If he were to do that, he would be averaging a triple-double for the season. As a 7-foot center, he is averaging 8.8 assists a game, shooting upwards of 60% from two, upwards of 40% from three, 50% from the field, and ultimately 85% from the free throw line.
But regardless, I think what Embiid's done, though, the argument for Embiid's that it's almost equally impressive, if not more impressive, because he's had a less stable supporting cast. I mean, I know he's had Harris and Simmons. Don't get me wrong. I know he's had them. But there's been stretches where Embiid has had to take the team on his own back because Simmons or Harris were out of the lineup at a certain point in time. Granted, Harris hasn't missed that many games this year, but Simmons has missed quite a few too. Also, I just believe that this year, I mean, it's tough because I think both conferences are kind of in terms of like equality. I think they're both pretty equal. I mean, top to bottom, the West is better, like in my opinion. But the top part of the West is very similar to top part of the East this year. If not, you can make a damning case that the East now probably has a better top four than the West does in terms of actual of win equity.
Interesting point you make, Mike. You're talking about the top part of the Eastern Conference. I just want to say something real quick. Sorry, Mark. I don't mean to cut you off here. But you know who's in fourth place in the East right now? Do you guys want to say it for me, or do you want me to say it?
I'm surprised you didn't make your MVP case yet. We were talking about that.
I don't want to jinx it.
If you had a vote, I know where it's going.
So we are all mentioning here and all kind of alluding to the New York Knicks, who are playing the best basketball in the whole goddamn NBA association. It is not the 1970s. Willie Reed didn't just come on the court. Walt Frazier's not playing basketball anymore. Melo's back, not back in New York. Guess who's back? It's the New York fucking Knickerbockers are back. And I am glad they're back, because they make
– really, because you talked a lot of shit when I told you they're going to win the championship.
Because they're still not –
because they're still going to win this fucking finals, bro. This is it. This is our year.
I will put my left nut on they would not win the finals, but it is awesome to see them playing good basketball.
Yo, you keep betting this shit, bro.
No.
Listen, I'll take you up on it.
What?
Bet your left nut.
You're going to carve out my left nut like Jack Kevorkian?
I will Lance Armstrong you today.
Okay.
If it means that the Knicks win a championship. I'll go to prison.
You can catch.
I'll do the time, bro. I don't have a face for prison. They will fuck me in the ass when I get there. But I will do it for a Knicks championship today.
You know what? I will gladly make that bet. You can write it down. I'll castrate my left nut if the Knicks actually make it and win the NBA Finals. Because that will not happen, okay? Let's get something straight here. But it is fantastic to see them playing great basketball. And it's great to see how Julius Randle is playing on a goddamn another level right now. It is mightily impressive. He's the runaway most improved player this year. And we'll get to that a different time, that whole debate of MIP. But RJ Barrett's playing great basketball. This team's extremely well coached. All the pieces are utilized extremely well by Tibbs. This is a very encouraging basketball to see from a team that's needed it for the last decade, and it's great to see them doing this now.
No, the best part, too, from my perspective, I just love it so much because the Knicks are doing this in a season where not their entire fan base, but half of their fake ass New York fan base had all jumped ship in the offseason and became Nets fans. So it is so refreshing to see this team exceed the expectations that they have and kind of shove it to the city that a lot of them, I mean, I know so many people that just suddenly became, this is what I hate about New York sports, is they all have 2-3 teams, so they can just jump ship whenever they want. Not the case of Nick at all. He's been all in on the Knicks since day one and never jumped ship to the Nets. But I just respect the fuck out of that because they're playing in the Garden. This is New York's team. It's not the Nets. The Nets went out and bought all their players, and the Knicks have done it in an underdog way, an underdog mentality. They're the number 4 seed right now, and their season has been far more impressive than the Nets. I just love the fact that they're doing that because the fans deserve it. The real New York fans who go to the Garden and have missed watching this team play at an elite level, they can see a promising future now. And a couple months back, I brought up the point that this team was about to be in limbo for a long time. I don't necessarily think it's impossible right now that that still happens, but they've showed strides where it's like, you know what? They have formidable management right now, and that's the most important thing. And if this team, with their legacy, can show that they're building something here. And the biggest reason right there is two guys, not even Julius Randle, because he is an aging veteran. If it wasn't for RJ Barrett,
bro,
and
he's like
Emmanuel Quigley.
Whoa, aging, bro.
What the fuck you mean, bro? He's 20. He's like my age. What the fuck you mean aging? Yeah, you're saying I'm aging, bro? That's fucked up.
He's 26. Let's relax.
He feels like it because he's been in the league forever, but he's not that old. He's been in the league since he was 19.
What's his contract situation with the Knicks right now, though? He's not long term with them.
No, I think
he hasn't gotten a long term contract, right?
I think he's got 2 years.
Yeah, so they definitely could re-sign him as well. I'm just more saying, as far as youth and guys you drafted, Quigley and RJ Barrett is key to this team because RJ Barrett has exceeded my expectations and then some. He's had a more impressive year than Ja Morant. And I think that's huge for New York is to be able to build around those two guys. And you're adding a complimentary – I mean, I'm not calling Julius Randle a complimentary player, but down the road, if you're asking him to be your two, that's a pretty good
and
core right
And
there.
That's the thing, too, is now you get the New York allure back with the Knicks. So you get that rich franchise history. You show that you're a team that's on the rise. You eventually can get some pretty high-profile free agency, and you don't have to strike out on guys on bloated contracts of, like, Carlos Boozer, who's, like, on his last leg for $15 to $20 million a year. Now you can actually go out and use some of your cap space effectively and get guys that can actually play well for you. And the thing with the Knicks is, that's number two. That's it again. They have a ton of cap space. They have a great market. They have young talent. And they have guys within the next 2 years, they can build a super team. They can get two superstar contracts to go along with Julius Randle and RJ Barrett within the next 2 years. And if they do that, they can actually win the NBA Finals. And they will be a serious threat to win the NBA.
And you won't bet your left nut in those years that they will.
No, because
they've already won 8 straight.
Yeah.
Just saying. They've won 8 straight games. So, against good teams, some of them too. Last night against the Hawks, that game went down to the wire, OT. You know, Julius had made a couple stupid mistakes, but, man, the vision on that guy is off the charts for a big man.
Oh, yeah.
It really is off the charts. It's something that is very impressive, and I've seen it in spades in other years, but this year he really took it to a new level. And I'm happy for him, but I think we need to move on because I want to start to talk about these positions. Now, shout out to Rashad. You know, he's been a huge advocate for the podcast for the past week. He's been, you know, talking about us, which is awesome. And, you know, I can't thank that guy enough for all of the love that he's been sending our way. And for all the people who follow him, who might be listening, welcome. We appreciate you tuning in. Hopefully we didn't lose you from the prison comment, but you know, if we didn't, you're still here. Awesome. We're going to keep talking about these positions. We went through the guards last week. And there was a lot of guard positions, but this week we're going to go through the forwards. And I think in today's NBA, the way that it's structured, some of the most important positions happen to be in the forward/center realm. And so I want to just dive right into it, guys. The first one here is your small forward. And to really break a small forward down as it is listed for Rashad Phillips, it's essentially like a shooting guard, except a little bit bigger. It's a shooting guard who has a little bit more size and a little bit more responsibility when it comes to rebounding. But they're primarily working off of the ball to gather their offense. And that's what we see with a lot of these small forward guys. So the prototype that he talks about is somebody like a Kawhi, somebody like Paul George, Jason Tatum, those types of guys. I would also throw in names like Jimmy Butler, probably Chris Middleton, definitely Michael Porter Jr. at this point. So those are like the names that I would think of. I don't know if you guys can think of anything else, anybody else. I know like the historic prototype, probably the person who he might have been thinking about when he was writing this out is Carmelo Anthony, for sure. Like that's exactly what he was his entire career and still is to this day. Do you guys think of anybody else?
Let me add to that list. DeMar DeRozan is a guy I would add to that list because he's a guy that he comes off the ball. He comes, gets the ball, and he basically puts the ball in the net from 15 to 20 feet away off his mid-range. He can drive to the net. He gives you 5 to 6 rebounds a night. He's a guy that can shoot from three sometimes. We've seen his three-pointer get more improved as years have went on. He works off the ball. He can give you an efficient 20 to 23 points a game. And he's a guy that can give you an array of different ways he can score, too. And he does all that off the ball while maintaining his rebounding responsibility. So I would put him in the small forward criteria for sure.
Yeah, I think a lot of the swing guards that you might have been. I mean, it's exactly how this chart works, where they all transition into the next one below it. So a lot of those shooting guards that we might not have mentioned are all going to fall into this category. Or not shooting guards, but shooting guards slash small forwards. I guess you could put Jimmy Butler in here, yeah, right?
Yeah, I mentioned Jimmy.
Jimmy Butler would probably.
Yes.
Yeah.
Jimmy Butler would definitely fit under this umbrella. And these guys are key to their teams. And I feel like you get a lot of really strong defenders in this category.
Yeah, 100%, because again, when you are 6'7" to 6'9", you're going to have to guard multiple positions. I mean, how many times have we seen Kawhi Leonard and Paul George having to go up against Anthony Davis together? I mean, that's the thing, is that when you get to this realm, you have such a wide array of responsibility that you become arguably, underratedly, one of the most important players of a championship team, because at the end of the day, you have a huge responsibility offensively to put up 20-plus points a game efficiently in an array of different ways. And then you go back on defensive end, and you're more than likely guarding either the big man of the team or you're guarding the best scorer of that team, and you're taking the toughest defensive assignment. So the NBA is rich with forwards, and it's been rich with forwards the last 10 years and in the new era of playing basketball, with trying to find interchangeable guys at small ball to play the 3, 4, and 5. And I think these guys that we've mentioned have been the prototypes that NBA teams are looking to go out and go draft or go out and go buy in free agency.
I think these guys have a lot of value in free agent markets. I don't know if a team's always going to be looking for this as a high draft pick, mainly because sometimes these guys can be kind of boxed into a pretty typecast position as a small forward because they don't have as much of an ability on the ball to initiate plays as somebody like the next position that we'll talk about here. The one thing that I did want to mention before we move along, to go on to piggyback on your point, Mike, when we saw, I mean, the first time the Bucks caved in the playoffs as a one seed against the Raptors in the Western Conference Finals, yeah, right, or the semis,
yeah,
in the finals, who was guarding Giannis the whole time?
Kawhi
yeah. Leonard. You know, got at least 4 inches on him and still locked him down the entire time. So I think that's a very good point that you make. They are required to guard more positions as a shooting guard would be. Shooting guards should be able to lock down anywhere from 1 to 3. I think that a small forward should be able to lock down anywhere from 1 to 4, sometimes even all 5.
Yes.
That's an important thing for the two-way aspect of it.
Let me before we move on, I want to add something real quick in terms of the draft pick. What I meant by buying in terms of draft capital is going out in a lottery and picking guys up. The guys you mentioned, they might not go within the top 5 like Jason Tatum did, obviously, but guys are being bought nowadays within the lottery. We've seen this at such a more prolific rate in the NBA. I mean, like Paul George was a lottery pick. Kawhi Leonard was a lottery pick. All these guys nowadays are becoming lottery picks. I mean, look at even Anthony Edwards, for Christ's sake, a guy that can probably maybe fit in this category as a guy that can be a future staple of this category. I mean, yeah, he plays shooting guard too, but I mean, I personally classify him as more of a small forward. And the fact is, he was taken with the first overall pick. I just believe that the NBA nowadays is going to use high draft assets within the lottery to go out and get players like these, because they can be used in so much more versatile ways than we see the guys at the guards positions can be used, because of just the way the NBA is going in terms of having versatility on defense and being able to score an array of ways offensively as well.
Yeah, and I like the point you bring with lottery picks, is I think this is a position that's sought in the lottery, and two guys that are most recent lottery picks from 2 seasons ago that I think have developed very nicely into this category and are only going to go up from here are your boy RJ Barrett. I would put him in this category, and DeAndre Hunter, one of my favorite young players in the league. I think it just speaks to how important it is to build. I mean, it's important to build around every position, but we've seen so many teams that start with this position, build that team around it, because it's so important to be an all-around player at the small forward.
I'll be honest, I think that RJ might be a little too small for this. I mean, he's 6'5". He's got the size width-wise, but I think he would probably fall more into the shooting guard category just because of his size. Like, he's off the ball. I think the difference mainly is just like if he had like 3 inches on him, then definitely he would be a small forward. I agree with you on DeAndre Hunter. I do believe that he would fall into this. Cam Reddish probably would as well if he ever, you know, gets his shit together. No, he's doing fine. He's doing fine. Anyway, next up, this is the most important position probably on the entire out of all of them that we're going to talk about today, and that is the dual forward position. Now, the dual forward position, as it is described by Rashad, is the do-it-all position. He says this player serves as usually the offensive initiator, facilitator, rebounder, and scorer. Typically, the number one position for their style of play that generates tons of stats across the board. A dual forward is the most dangerous position in basketball, and the biggest names in the league tend to fall into this category. We're talking, this is where LeBron falls. This is where Luka Doncic falls. This is where Ben Simmons falls. There's a lot of different names that you can mention to go into the dual forward position because there is so much that goes into this position that it's necessary to encapsulate all of it within one position. And as opposed to saying that Luka's a point guard, LeBron's a small forward, you know, what the fuck even is Ben Simmons? We don't know. That's why this position makes sense. Because he's clearly this. This is exactly what he is. He's a dual forward. He does forward shit, and then he does guard shit. That's the difference, you know? So out of those names, I also wanted to mention the best historic prototype for this position is absolutely Larry Bird. That's exactly what he used to do. It's clear that that's what this position was made for. Somebody like a Larry Bird, somebody like you could even make a slight case for Scottie Pippen, but I don't know if I would. But yeah. So what do you guys think about this? Do you have any other names that you could put in this? There's a lot of them.
I would like a name that just sticks out to me like right away is Julius Randle, as I would put in here, because I think he's exactly this. He's a guy that plays the forward position to a T, but then also he has these guard tendencies, like we talked about, his vision, where he can go out and get you 6 to 8 assists a night if he really puts his mind to it, and sometimes he can even give you triple doubles within a game. And the fact of the matter is that when he puts his mind to it, he's a guy that shows these tendencies. Does he bring the ball up? Sometimes he does, but not at a rate like Ben Simmons or LeBron James does. But I think he fits more of that role that we talked about with Larry Bird as a guy of like a historic role. Like Julius Randle, honestly, is kind of in the wrong era of basketball. Like he's not in the wrong era in terms of like him like fitting in, because he has a good fit in the NBA, in today's NBA as well. But back then, he just feels like a guy that was like that should have played in the 90s in terms of just the versatility that he brings, in terms of the brand of basketball he brings as well. But, yeah, I think that Julius Randle's a guy that goes into this. And even you can make the case for Zion Williamson, too.
So, really quick, yeah, Mark, before you go, think about those names as you go into the next position, too, Mike. And let me know when we get to that position if you think they fall into dual forward, if they fall into the next one we talk about. But we'll get back to it, okay?
Yeah. For me, the name I really want to bring up, and I don't think you mentioned him yet, but Michael Porter Jr., is somebody I think would fit into this nicely, because he's somebody that's still developing, but he can bring up the ball and he can do a lot of those things, especially in college. He was talked about as like a Ben Simmons type that can do a little bit of everything, has good vision. Do you guys think Pascal Siakam would fit here?
I wouldn't put him here. So again, the next position is going to make sense. It's you're going to see the difference here in a second. Also, going to Michael Porter Jr., I honestly, in the style of play that he has right now, I feel like I'll put him more into the small forward category. His assist percentage is like, it's like bottom 20 percentile right now. He's averaging, I think, less than an assist a game during his hot streak. He's over 20 points a game for the month of April, and he's been over 20 points a game, I think, also in the month of March, but his assists have actually plummeted in that time frame, mainly because of who is actually the facilitator of that offense, but also he has the capability. I just don't think he's using it right now. He could definitely turn into this, but I think as it stands right now, he's more of an off-the-ball kind of guy and would fall into the small forward category. There is one name that I haven't mentioned intentionally, and I'm going to hold off on mentioning it because it's going to be the first thing that I'm going to talk about with this next position.
Would you agree that Michael Porter coming out of college would have fit here? And that's why last week, if you remember, I forget who it was. I mentioned somebody's name who was a rookie, and you were like, let's not do rookies because we got to see where they fall into. And I think that's a great point, is especially who you get drafted to and how that team develops. Michael Porter coming out of college was like a prototypical dual forward. And just like you said, he joins Jokic, and he's not the main facilitator on that team, and the assists have taken it.
Right. Yeah, and the fact of the matter is just Michael Porter at this point is a guy that is a catch-and-shoot type of guy, a guy that he gets the ball kicked out to him, and then he puts the ball on the deck. He's basically an off-the-ball type of scorer, like we've talked about, and I think he fits that small forward criteria to a team rather than the dual four because, like Nick said, he's not much of a passer. And honestly, his rebounding sometimes leads a lot to be desired. Like, yeah, he could stack up rebounds at times, but there's also games where he puts up like 24 points and only three rebounds. Like, his rebounding is very inconsistent as well.
So, yeah, the rebounding, it definitely should be better just because of his size. I mean, right now his defensive rebounding percentage is 21%, which is actually pretty good. 85 percentile, you know. His assist percentage is in the fifth, you know, so it's like he's just not doing it. But that being said, also, he does take care of the basketball, though, because his turnovers in the 87th, he's at 8% turnover rating, which is actually very, very good. And his offensive plus minus 3.2, that's in the top 95. But his defense is, you know, it leaves a lot to be desired, especially for his size. You'd think there'd be a little bit more to it. He's got great height, great size, and that's going to probably add as he gets older. I don't think that the Nuggets need him to be that, and therefore he does not become that position. If he were to, I think he can turn into that. As it stands right now, he's not.
Yeah.
So dual forward is what we talked about here. The next up, we have a hybrid post, right? And as a hybrid post, Rashad describes this as following. It's a big that brings hyper versatility on both ends of the court, can play with their backs to the basket, pick and pop, pick and lob, and or initiate the offense. This position is very unique style, and teams with this type of player should feel lucky. I agree with this. His prototypes on this are Anthony Davis and Bam Adebayo. So that's the kind of mindset you want to think when you're talking about players with this. This is where I would put Randall. That's why I was mentioning, like, keep that name in your head. Because this is where I would put Randall. I think he falls right in the middle, though. So you have a very good point with putting him in as a dual forward. He falls right in the middle because of the ability to assist. Siakam definitely falls into this one. I think
And Zion.
This
too.
Is exactly where Zion would fit too. This is a Zion Williamson position. DeMontis Sabonis for sure. And then
yeah, I was just about
the historic
to say,
prototypes that I was thinking of. This is where Hakeem would definitely fall, and Kevin Garnett. As you mentioned him before, that's why it was funny that you mentioned him, because I have him in my notes here. The person who I was going to talk about, and this is what I wanted to bounce off of you guys. I was actually talking to Rashad about this today. So we haven't mentioned Giannis yet, right? And it's clear that Giannis, it seems like he would be a dual forward because of the way he plays. So I think what I was thinking when I was writing my notes down is that, yes, right now, Giannis Antetokounmpo would fall into the dual forward category. But I personally believe that if they were to use him as a hybrid post exclusively and use him as this type of player, I think that he would be highly effective here as well. What do you guys think?
Oh, 100%. I mean, we've seen stretches where he is uses this throughout games, and that's where he has his best scoring outputs. The problem with Giannis at times is that when we see Giannis struggle, it's two things. One, he's settling on too many jumpers. And number two, he's turning over the ball too much. If they used him as a hybrid post, they eliminate both his weaknesses and both the things that drag down Giannis and ultimately plateau the Milwaukee Bucks in every single playoff series. So I absolutely agree. I, in fact, would argue that using Giannis Antetokounmpo as a hybrid post would be so much more effective and so much better for the Bucks in terms of their success, rather than using him as that dual forward, as the guy in this year in that LeBron James type of role. Because I just feel as if at times that's where they get buried in terms of that. And it's not his fault. It's just that he's getting asked to do way too much for a guy that at the end of the day, his jump shot is still extremely limited. I know it's gotten a lot better from what it once was, but still, I live with Giannis Antetokounmpo taking a 25-foot three-point jump shot every single day of the week.
Well, and also, because, I mean, if I think about, if I compare him to somebody like an Anthony Davis, like, he is similar size to AD. Like, AD is actually shorter than him. And AD runs as a big man, whereas Giannis works as more of like a big guard, right? And
a big slasher.
And
yes.
If you thought about if AD played the way that Giannis played, he could probably get away with it. But we would be talking about him in the same kind of context that we talk about Giannis Antetokounmpo. If he were to pull up from three, he's a good three-point shooter, but we don't see the kind of volume of threes that we see from somebody like Giannis. Giannis takes him off of the dribble, and we've had this conversation, so we won't have it again, of how ineffective it is when he does that and how much better it is when he's getting it off of the block and off of the catch. That's why I think that this is better place for him. Who knows if he'll ever get utilized this way? I think his usage rate won't even be affected by it, and I don't think his numbers at all will be affected by it. And it's not like his numbers in terms of assists and all of that stuff are going to drop because of this. It just means that they use him a different way, and I think that it's important to see that, even though the fact that I think Budenholzer just kind of tells him that he can do whatever he wants, and that's what he wants to do. You know, Mark, what do you think about this, and do you think of any other hybrid posts that you can anybody else pop into your head? Right now, again, I have AD, Bam, Giannis, Randall, Siakam, and Domantas Sabonis.
What's weird is the height, because I think height can falsely, like, it almost, like, plays tricks in our minds on where these guys fall into sometimes, because there are players that it's like their height, they play like a hybrid post, but their height doesn't really match up with it. Do you guys think that Draymond Green would fit here, or would Draymond go into that dual forward category? The other one is Tobias Harris. When you watch the Sixers play, he screams small forward, but then when you watch those Sixers style this offseason, he plays with his back to the basket a lot of the time. It's been an adjustment for him. It's not how we're used to seeing him the rest of his career, but he's been really effective on the post.
Yeah, I mean, I think they utilize him in the post when he has that smaller defender on him. So I think situationally, he would be like a hybrid post. But I think in his overall context, in his overall classification, you put him in the small forward type of criteria, because I think he plays more like a small forward, I would say like 70% of the time. But when he does get that mismatch, which is often because of the way the Sixers like dedicate their lineups and move around their lineups, then you can say that he's at a hybrid post. Because you're right, he does play that back to the basket. He takes that 15-footer like post fantasy jumper a lot, and he shoots over guys all the time. So that's a valid point, Mark. I really like that school of thought right there. Who is the other guy you mentioned too? I'm sorry.
Draymond. Where would Draymond fit here?
I think Draymond, it's tough. I think Draymond's a hybrid post because at this point of his career, he's really limited offensively to where he has to score within the paint because his three-point jump shot's failing. But like when he was in his prime on those Warrior teams, he was definitely that dual forward. Because he was that guy that did everything.
There's another possible position that we'll get to moving forward that he might have also fallen into in his prime. But I agree with you. I would say probably in the range of a dual forward / hybrid, in the sense of he initiates, you know, he's a play initiator on occasion. Let's just talk about Draymond when he was at his prime, right? He initiated the plays. The offense ran a lot of times through him, and he had the vision to be able to facilitate offense. So dual forward makes sense there. But there's another one that actually comes up with, you know, the style of play that they were playing and the lineups that they ran. He actually had a little bit of an even different role from either one of those two to mention there. So those are the hybrid posts. The next position is truly like dying, which is funny because it's one of the major positions that we have today, and that's the power forward position. And as a power forward is described by Rashad, he says, the standard back-to-the-basket scorer that provides interior production on both ends of the court. He says, typically this position rarely leaves the painted area and does their damage at close range. This position is starting to become less and less as the game has changed from space and pace to space and pace basketball. Now, it is very uncommon to find a power forward who does not shoot from deep. It's very difficult to find a power forward who doesn't do most of their damage from the mid-range or from the exterior. For someone who actually does most of their offensive production from inside the paint. It's uncommon, but it is still available. The prototypes that he uses is somebody like a Montrezl Harrell, somebody like a Tristan Thompson. If we want to go back in time with this, I think a prototype that makes a lot of sense with this particular position is Kevin McHale, and you can also make a case for Tim Duncan. And Tim Duncan, while he liked mid-range shot, I think a lot of his work was using his footwork on the inside and getting to the basket that way. So those two, where we call them to this day, you know, the greatest power forwards of all time, McHale and Duncan are usually in that conversation. I would say that they still would fall into that category, even with these updated positions.
Oh, yeah. So who would you guys say? I'm going to ask this question. Who would you guys say right now in the current NBA falls in this criteria?
Oh, he said, I was saying he, I was just using Rashad's prototypes. You know, he said Montrez, Tristan Thompson. Yep. Those are like the big two right there. Let's see if I wrote other ones down. I think that the Lakers are trying to use Andre Drummond as one right now. He's a little bit big for it, but I think that's what they're using him as with Marc Gasol in those lineups without AD there. So when AD comes back, he's going to move to a center position. But as it stands right now, I think that's where they're using him. Taj Gibson for sure. That's definitely his position. You're not going to see anybody who really like stands out and does this.
Now, he's out of the NBA at this point, but I think would T-Bone fit in this category? Zach Randolph? I feel like
Z-Bo?
That's somebody that sorry.
Yeah. Did you say T-Bone? No, he would.
Z-Bo.
You said T-Bone. T-Bone, like, I was like, yo, you hungry or something, Mark? Dude, I was like, what the fuck is
T-Bone? I must be.
I'm supposed to know who that is.
I must be.
No, Z-Bo would definitely fall into this. This is kind of like characterized for him. Something that he would fall smack dab in the middle of. He was a power forward, obviously, when he was playing. I still think he would fall into that. He had a mid-ranger. He shot a couple threes once in a while, but he definitely was doing his damage from the inside. So that's a good example right there.
Another example real quick. Derek Favors, a guy that fits this to a T.
I actually put him down. That was another one that I wrote down. I agree with that. All of his production really does take place on the inside. Old school Bulls teams. Not old school, but like 2010 Bulls. You could say either Joakim or Al Horford back then.
Or Boozer too.
Boozer had a big mid-range game. So I like to think like, these are guys who have the ability to step out and maybe shoot it from 15, but they're not consistent with it. And if they shot that shot, their coach isn't like nodding his head. If they shot from distance, their coach isn't going to be happy with that shot. It's not considered a good shot for this guy to shoot from anywhere outside of 10 feet. They'll do it, but it's not a good shot. So there's not that many options here. It's not a huge position anymore.
Wait, what about John Collins?
No, see, I looked at his advanced stats. The guy's shooting like 37% from three.
So where would you characterize him at then?
He would be either a hybrid or the next position we'll talk about, because he shoots like a decent amount of threes.
Okay.
I want to bring up one more player, and he's difficult too because he did a lot of his work from mid-range, but Paul Millsap could maybe fit here, especially with his Hawks days.
I would say maybe more hybrid because he did have a big mid-range game and you like to take those like 15 footers like repeatedly and there are like high percentage shots for him. But I would say he's that mix of like hybrid and like old school power forward.
Yeah.
In like 2008 basketball terms, he would definitely have been a hybrid, but in today's basketball terms, he's more of a power forward. I actually agree with you on that one. You know, he uses his size well. Like, remember Chuck Hayes from the Rockets?
Oh, God.
He's fucking 6'6", playing.
Worst free throw form I've ever seen.
Atrocious from free throw. But he was like 6'6", and played like interior basketball. So he made himself a power forward. You know what I mean? So like something like that. So the power forward, again, not common anymore. Dying position, going away. Next one, significantly more common. And this is your stretch big. And a stretch big does most of his damage from the perimeter. So these are the guys who sometimes, the way I considered it, is somebody who is almost frustratingly shooting threes. Someone who doesn't feel like they should have to shoot a three, but they'll do it anyway. And that's kind of becoming more and more common in the NBA today. So the obvious, like, there's one name that screams out for me, and that's KP. Like, Porzingis will fucking shoot a three when he's got a like a 7-inch mismatch on someone, could easily have backed him down, but he chooses, elects instead to shoot a three. Same thing with Miles Turner. Miles Turner's the exact same way. And you know, we're saying that's like a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. It's just like the stretch big.
It's annoying.
It's annoying in that sense. It used to be a case of like a huge, it's a huge advantage. It used to be. Now it's common. So now it's more of like nobody, the guys who aren't able to combine those things and become more of a hybrid type post, these are now your stretch guys who are stepping back more than working on the inside. Karl Anthony Towns, he's a good example of this. Brook Lopez today. Blake is definitely like this now. Christian Wood is definitely a stretch big. And then Marcus Morris actually has become a stretch big. He's shooting 48% from three this year. I don't know if you guys know this. He's shooting 48% from three, hitting over two a game.
Both, I guess you could call both. Yeah, I mean, that's insanity.
Mark Heath doesn't shoot like that. He shoots, but not like that.
No, I know, not like 48%, no. But I'm saying you probably could call both Morris twins that, like, you know, that hybrid stretch type of player right there. But, yeah, I mean, I think Kristaps Porzingis is the guy that you think of right now as the current NBA that fits this. And then, obviously, I think when you go look at, like, the historical significance of this position, I mean, the first name that comes out is Dirk Nowitzki.
Right.
I mean, that's the number one guy that you think right away. And the thing with Dirk was that, this is what separates Dirk greatness from almost any other guy that falls in this category, is that he knew how to blend it so well with, like, he took a volume of threes, but he never, like, it felt like when you watched him, he was so smart and he had such a high IQ of basketball that he knew when to, like, take advantage of that mismatch. Like, that's where Kristaps needs to learn from Dirk and from the same organization that taught Dirk those things, is that he needs to blend in both sides more and become that hybrid and embrace that he's a 7'3" guy, 7'2", that literally, if he gets a little baby jump hook, can literally not be stopped within the paint and offensively, probably. And he would be a deadly 1-2 punch with the Luka Doncic, more so than he is right now.
I have the most frustrating example of this personally. Just because I don't know why he just – there's so many moments in my history as a Sixers fan that he has drove me fucking insane. And that's Kelly Olynyk. Olynyk is – dude, he shoots the ball from three exactly what you're talking about, Nick, where it's like he shoots to the point where, like, you're like, what the fuck are you doing? Why are you taking that shot? And also in that same breath, like, Frank Kaminsky does sort of the same thing.
Yeah.
As we go forward in the NBA, this is going to become more common. I think that it's not going anywhere. I think it's going to become the most predominant thing that we'll see. The really high-level ones will be hybrid. The ones who aren't as high-level will probably start to resort to their three-point shots and become a stretch big. So that's kind of common today. The second-to-last one we have is your traditional center, right? A center position, as it's described by Rashad, is usually the biggest player on your team that provides interior offense, defense, and rebounding. Not typically your most dangerous position on your team today, but still a valuable asset if you get the right one. Sometimes they are very dangerous assets. When you guys think of this position from what I described, what names pop out at you?
I mean, like historically, like Shaq. Like, this is like
Shaq,
the true
center. Yeah, this is Shaq, yeah.
Yeah, this is Shaq. This is Embiid. This is guy. These are guys that
David Robinson.
You see Pup 30 something points in the game and 20 something rebounds to go along with it. These are guys that you give the ball down the block, they take two steps and boom, they're right. They're either right at the rim. They're shooting a little fadeaway hook. They're using their post moves. They're using their feet work inside to beat you up and beat you down. And they're going to physically be in an imposing type of way. Yao Ming is another historical example of this. So Drew Sigelgauskas, for Christ's sake, is an example of this. I had to go off in a different direction.
I think you can honestly make a case for Yao being more hybrid, though. I mean, he had really good vision. He had the ability from outside. There's a lot of opportunities for him there. But I think that he was able to recognize he was just the biggest fucking guy there. You know?
Well, yeah, that's my point. Just yeah, the way he could have been more. He could have been more as a hybrid, but the fact was he was fucking like 7'6", and he was like, "Yeah, I'm just gonna dominate inside the paint."
Mark, let me ask you something.
Yeah.
Would you put Embiid here, or would you put him as a hybrid post?
He is so tough with this because he does both. I think you have to almost do a hybrid post though, because, dude, he just. When I think of this more as prototypical, and Embiid is not prototypical, and I think Olajuwon is the comparison that everyone makes, and I can't put Olajuwon in this category, so therefore I don't think I could do Embiid. I think I would he's right in between the two. It's almost unfair to put him in one or
that's
the other.
That's actually what Rashad said specifically, he's in between. Here's my case for him being a center, because yes, he is in between, but I think that the Sixers would rather him use his size than have him play on the perimeter. Is that unfair?
No, that's 100% right. The hit's the nail right in the head. I mean, we've seen how the Sixers actually try to, like, people forget the Sixers actually try to utilize Embiid as a more perimeter option, as a guy that can do both. And now they're using him as the center that he's destined to be, entered a one seed in the East for a reason. And that's because they're a more successful team.
Exactly. And what's interesting is go back to the Tobias Harris talk. Tobias Harris has changed his role and changed his position on this chart, and it has directly affected Embiid's play and his changing position. Exactly. I think depending on what Tobias is doing, that is affecting how you would place Embiid in this.
No.
Exactly.
I think you have to place Embiid in this center role due to the fact that I think Embiid lacks one thing, is his vision. He doesn't have – not that his vision's poor, but it's not the best. I mean, every time – still to this day, when he gets double-teamed and he has the ball, I start biting my fingernails because I know a turnover is cooking up somewhere or some ridiculous pass is going across half the court and it's going to be up for grabs for people. And the fact is, I think Embiid lacks that vision aspect to be truly a hybrid guy. So I personally think that the way I would go about this is playing him in the center. I think there's a valid argument to play him as a hybrid because he can stretch the floor. But I would say he's a center in today's NBA, and he's a true center due to the fact that he doesn't go out and like go about passing the basketball. When he gets a basketball, he has one intention: to score. And he's either going to score when he catches and shoots from three, or he's going to score when he catches it on the block and dominates whatever center is on him, whether that be a hybrid center, whether that be a guy that, like, you know, he's going to get the ball and dominate. He's going to give you 25 and 10 every single night, without a doubt.
I think, too, this position screams, like, you guys ever see in a box score, or sometimes you even get a notification from like Bleacher Report or something when it's like Clint Capella has 16 rebounds at halftime. Like, that is a center. When you get that notification that Clint Capella has 16, that DeAndre Jordan has fucking 12 rebounds in the first quarter. Those are your centers that are just dominating down low.
All great examples of true centers, too, is both Capella and DeAndre Jordan as well. Guys that just dominate in the paint and are used strictly in the paint and are the paint protectors of their team as well.
And shoot at absurdly high percentages because of this.
The names that I have written down were Ayton, Gobert, Clint Capella, Jared Allen, Steven Adams, Andre Drummond, Vooch, you know, names like that.
Whiteside,
Hassan Whiteside. Prime Whiteside. Yeah, I mean, you know,
you can make the argument for Vucha to be a hybrid post though, because he can.
He's got the capability of doing both. Yeah, he's sort of like a smack dab in the middle, the very similar way that Embiid is, where he could fall into each, and it's really up to how he wants to use his size.
Yes.
So the last one is very unique, and we only got one example of it really in the NBA today, and that's
There's more.
You think so?
I'll make a case for a couple. We'll get to it.
So the point center, everybody who's listening, if you know anything about basketball, you know kind of who this is kind of geared around. The team's biggest post player that serves as the initiator, passer, scorer, and focal point, as according to Rashad, this position is rarely seen or used in the NBA, but proves to be effective when surrounded by willing slashers and shooters. The first ever example of this was Bill Russell. He was the play initiator. He was essentially, everybody just ran around him the entire time on offense. So first example of that, Bill Walton was the next one that that's major one. Can make a case for Wilt. However, I do believe that he led the league in assists just because they told him that he couldn't. So I don't know if that really counts him as a point center. I think he's just kind of an ego guy. So Arvydas Sabonis is another one, probably in his prime more than when he got to the NBA, but he definitely wasn't another example. And the one that we see today is Nikola Jokic averaging 8.8 assists a game, runs the offense as a 7-foot center, and is able to facilitate the entire team's offense from that position. And it is really uncommon, unheard of. This is what I was talking about, Mike, before, because when the Warriors were in their prime and Draymond was younger, he was the biggest guy on the court and he was the play initiator. So I could say, I think you could also say that Draymond 4 years ago was also a point center in his own right.
Oh yeah, 100%. I mean, he was the guy that he brought up the ball at times as the biggest player on the court, as the biggest player on that starting lineup and that death lineup. That's the fabled death lineup. And yeah, you can easily make the case for him in his prime of being that point center or that dual forward. It depends on whatever you want to dump in that criteria. I think he's right in the middle of both, and classify him as either one is completely fine with me, as I think both of those, and that's in it, just in his situation, are interchangeable.
All right, Mark, let's hear it.
So I'll take a step back and say that Jokic is the only one right now who's doing it on a game in, game out basis. Go look at the assist numbers on centers, and it's staggering how much it drops off from Jokic, Bam Adebayo, but he, as we talked about, he can't be in this situation, although he does do it at times. He assists the ball very well for his position, but we already went there. He can't quite fit into this category because of the other things that he does so well. I would argue Jusuf Nurkić has done this at times for the Portland Trailblazers, and it's ironic that he came up with Jokic. Are they from the same country? I'm not sure. I forget. Yeah, same country, and was with the Nuggets, basically learning from Jokic. He does do this at times with the Trailblazers. The other one I'll bring up, and it's a game-in, game-out basis, I think when he has the talent around him, like we've seen with the Raptors and the Lakers, Marc Gasol can fit into this category sometimes.
It's funny Rashad said that. He said Marc Gasol falls into this. I agree. That's a good point.
Yeah, Marc Gasol's Marc Gasol's a good point. I would say Jusuf Nurkić. He's a tough one because I think when I think of Jusuf Nurkić, I think of more like 18-8 and like 17-10, like 15-10, like those type of numbers from Jusuf Nurkić. I really don't think of him as assists. Like, yeah, he can give you like 4 to 5 assists without a doubt, but I wouldn't go to the stretch of a point center. I would say he's more of like the hybrid post, because he's not a guy that can get you done. When I think of a point center, I think of a guy that's going to get you 7-plus assists in any given night, or a guy that when he's thrust in that role can give you 7-plus assists. I think Jusuf Nurkić is capable of doing that, but we haven't seen him do it enough consistently to warrant that type of, that passer, that type of vision, that type of facilitator, type of label for him. I would say he more fits that 4 to 5 assists, and if he does that, then I think he goes into hybrid, because in that way he has a large bag of tricks that he can utilize, but that's not one of his chief calling cards. I think his chief calling cards are his rebounding, his tenacity on the boards, and just his like lower post scoring, and how he can score with inside, and how he just is a great guy that can slide to the rim and finish at the rim as well.
Yeah, correction. Nurkić is from Bosnia and Jokic is from Serbia. So yeah. No, they're not from the same place.
Okay. Same style of basketball though. Right. So it does fall under that. I completely agree, Mike. It's impossible to find somebody that does it at the level of Jokic. There's only guys that can do it when needed.
Yes.
The only other guy I want to bring up just for conversation's sake is, could we argue at any point in his career, did DeMarcus Cousins ever play a role similar to this? Especially the year in New Orleans, he did average almost 6 assists a game with Anthony Davis.
So that, funny you say that. That year in New Orleans, yes, I would have actually called him a point center, because he was at that point where, yeah, he was the guy that was averaging the assists. What he was doing was incredible. It's a shame that that ACL injury, Achilles injury, really sideswiped his prime in his career. It's terrible. But the bottom line is, yes, I agree with that. I think in his Kings days, he was a hybrid, or even, I would say, a hybrid. But in that 1 year, that like 40-game sample we had of Cousins with the Pelicans, absolutely, he was that point center. I would absolutely agree with that sentiment.
Yeah, I like that. I like that concept. You know, point center is a cool concept when it comes down to it, because I think we're going to start to see guys falling into this more now that we have a precedent, like a true precedent of this being like in the offense on a successful team.
Let me tell you, with the right coaching, Evan Mobley can easily do this.
I agree.
Yeah.
I think a lot of guys could. I mean, especially, like, think about this, right? Anthony Davis grew 7 inches in the summer, became a center because of out of necessity. But imagine if he didn't. Imagine if he was, like, if he was in a league where Jokic had already been established and this kind of style of offense had already been established, and now he was capable of being that guy too. So I think that now, because we see what it looks like, people are going to be able to implement it effectively. And so I think it's an interesting concept going into it. So, you know, we'll see how it manifests itself moving forward. I mean, Jokic is a fucking unicorn by himself. He's in a completely different league by himself. No one has really done what he's done ever. And we'll see if it even gets, you know, how far it goes from here. So that's the point center. So we've been through now all of the positions, and we're going to start to use these as we go through things like the draft, as we go through things like, you know, the GOATs, all that kind of stuff. If we talk about those kind of things, we'll try to reference it back to this. Sometimes I know I'll forget. I'm sure you guys will forget too. But this is important for today's NBA because it makes more sense. Like I mentioned last week, it makes more sense for the way that the game is played today. That's pretty much all I have to say. Do you guys have anything you want to follow up? Any final points?
So my final point is that shout out to Rashad Phillips for creating this like type of school of thought and this criteria. And shout out to him for giving this pod a lot of love. Really appreciate that, my man. But overall, I think this should be a school of thought that us as people that follow the NBA, that people NBA Twitter, that people that do what we're doing, this is a school of thought that I believe we should really, really utilize and really kind of embrace, because I think this makes a lot more sense. I think these as draft classifications are genius. I think these, looking into these type of classifications for players going down the line, can not only help like us like classify players and classify individual talent levels and everything, but I think the teams honestly should take a point or two from these as well, because if they're able to create a more of a, you know, specified filter for what they want to draft utilizing these type of criteria, they can, I think, nail what they're looking for to help their basketball team at such a more effective rate and prolific rate than we've seen in the last couple of years in terms of their drafting style and everything like that. And that's just all I have to say. Thanks for listening to the show. I'm happy to be here and happy to always talk about this, like, these type of things in basketball.
Yeah, and I think to touch on that, it's interesting because I'd like to get into the room of an NBA exec, a scout, and see if they are discussing maybe not the same exact positions that we are looking at, but I'd like to see if they are breaking players down in the draft classes differently than the standard five positions we're used to, because they're just inaccurate at this point. I think that's the biggest thing. It's grouping guys in to positions that they don't belong in, but the game has changed. And it's important to note, I believe, Nick, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that Rashad Phillips has been a scout before on some levels, and I'm not so sure if he is right now. He's an NBA analyst, but I think he also, I've seen him scouting high school games and whatnot. So this is somebody in the field that we can take his professional insight in the terms of the game of basketball, and I highly suggest you guys all go check him out on his social medias, because we've learned a lot from him, and we're going to continue to take a lot of the information that he presents us with and talk about it on the podcast.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sure he's been a scout for different teams. All I know is that right now he has his own thing, and he scouts heavily for high schoolers, mid-major prospects, all of that kind of stuff, guys who are under the radar, don't stay under the radar because guys like Rashad Phillips are in their they're in their gyms watching them work out and recognizing like true talent out of players who might not be playing against the best competition. But yeah, so that being said, we'll be back next week. We're going to probably try to do one more thing with this, or we might just go. It honestly depends on if some shit happens in the NBA. So season's winding down, 12 games left, at least for the Knicks. And fuck, they're in fourth. So that being said, hopefully Mike gets to keep his left testicle. And if you're not ugly, stay beautiful. We'll see you guys next week.